It's time for Driving Me Crazy, coming to you live from Beechtree Studios near beautiful Pinehurst, North Carolina. This is the only show where a husband and wife drive, talk cars and life, and still love one another each day. Here's John and Laurie. Or is it Laurie and John? Oh, take it away, you crazy kids.
Well, actually, right now it's John, because the crazy half of this wonderful union decided she needed to put the clothes in the washer and the dryer, apparently, right before the show came on. So it's like, wait a minute.
I
and she gets up and goes into the laundry room. It's like, you know, you guys out there that are married, I'm sure you understand what one deals with when working from the home. good morning, Hedy.
There are too many distractions in the home.
Yeah, and she's trying to finish that book. She's got another book deadline that she's working on in between words. So,
okay. Right.
But I'm sure that she'll pick up the phone any moment. Might have heard her in the background.
Well,
anyway, today we're going to talk about the Chevy Blazer RS and some other things. But let's talk about life for a minute. Everything okay on your end, Hezzy?
Thank God, I'm really doing good. So I'm pleased. Things are going forward. There's a lot of drama here in politics as usual. So
usual.
That makes life exciting. As usual. I mean,
what about
the only
weather?
Thing that keeps the
what
heart
about,
beating.
What about your weather?
Oh, the weather was so hot last week. I'm sure you suffered that as well. It was like
and
95.
Then,
it felt like 115.
And then day before
and then
yesterday.
The cool.
Yeah. Oh yeah, we had this incredible torrential downpour for about 3 or 4 hours, and then the front
yes.
followed through, and it's been 60. It was 64 or something last night, 60 the night before. Day before
exactly.
yesterday, the high was, I think it was, the high was 80, but it was like 72 almost all day. When you were in the shade, it was, you know, it was out of this world. It's what you pray for and why you put up with this hot weather to get a few of these days. And so
exactly.
yesterday it was like 82. I think today it's going to be 85, but it's sunny. There's very little humidity. It's just, it's out of this world when it's like this. You know?
Mm.
It's just absolutely
stunning. It's a blessing.
So,
Mother Nature.
So I hope you're having I hope you're having some of that in New York as well.
Absolutely. So
good
no,
morning.
We're doing very well. Good morning. So did you add the softener
too?
Better late
too? Than never, I suppose.
Or did it dryer?
Johnny's well, that part's true, but I was although yes, I'm working on another book, but no, what I was doing. Besides putting some sheets in the washing machine, which actually was just before airtime, I was finishing up, and we'll talk about this later, I was finishing up my research on Datsun.
Oh, yeah.
And,
all
you
right.
know, we thought we were going to talk about a dead brand no longer with us. It's far from
no,
the
it's
case. It's everywhere else in the world except India, Russia. It's alive and well, but we'll talk about that later. Instead, Johnny's going to launch off with a car we both enjoyed very much, the
brand new Chevy Blazer, the remake of the old Blazers.
What a beauty.
Yeah, and back in the, it had to be in the 80s, I suppose it was. I bought my first one. It was bright red, and it was four-wheel drive with lock-in, lock-out hubs. It was the K5. I mean, and it was a beast. It was literally a beast. Had the V8 350. And I'll just interject this now that the current ones have a V6 that's 308 horsepower. So, you know, it was a big, it was a bad dude with a big engine like, you know, V8 350. And I told Hezzy, you know, it had, you could put it in, it only came in, if you locked in the hubs, it was four-wheel drive high. And if you unlocked them, of course, it was just two-wheel drive, rear-wheel drive. And you could put it in low, four-wheel high and four-wheel low. And when you put it in four-wheel low, you could literally climb up a tree. You know, if the tree was bent over at all, you could climb up a tree. And I took it on some incredible journeys. I had a business. I was a professional guide on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, taking people goose hunting back in the 80s. And it just going – and I took it to Louisiana, to Arkansas duck hunting, to Louisiana duck hunting and goose hunting, the thing would go through mud, and it would go, you know, it would go through anything. It climbed up there was a dam that was made of these big stones, huge stones. And I looked at it one day, and I thought, you know how you are when you're like in your 20s and you feel invincible. And I looked at this big stone thing at that big stone dam, and I thought, I could drive up that. So I did. Of course, and you're going relatively slow and picking your way. But you know what? I got up to the top. I was on top of the dam, and then I turned and I thought, now I have to turn this thing somehow and get back down. And that was even more interesting than going up. But I made it. You know, God was with me, and I didn't turn over, didn't break anything, and all that kind of stuff. So, but. I had that one, and when I put about 110,000 miles on it, maybe, I decided to get another one, and I bought another K5 Blazer, the newer one. That had to be 1990, maybe, and that was a gray one, and it had a spoiler on the back of it. You know, this was they came out with it. With a spoiler that went on the back of, and the reason for that was when you're driving down the road, the design of the vehicle caused the dust to get all over the back window of your car. You just the way it pulled the air. And when they put that spoiler up, it made the air go down the back of the vehicle and kept your back window clean. Plus, it looked really cool, right. too, you know. So I had one of those, and loved it. It was an automatic. The first one was a four-speed, you know, four-speed on the column in the floor, and then in reverse, and that's what you had. But the second one was actually an automatic, and that was about the time that cell phones, they were just going from bag phones. Good gosh, people that are listening to this will think I've lost my mind, but you have to understand that, you know, 40, 50 years ago, things were different. And they had bag phones for cell phones, as he remembers that. And then they went to kind of a handheld unit, but you could mount it in your car. And what they did was put like a post in the floor of your car near where the stick shift was. And then the phone was attached to that. So it was kind of at your right hand as you were driving down the road. You could reach over and take it off of its just like a cradle. And you could, you know, the numbers were in the phone itself, so you pushed the buttons on the phone. There was no hands-free driving back then. Of course, there was nothing against drinking and driving back then. You could pull into the bar, and they always had a go window. That's what they were called, a go window, and you could pull up to the window and get a gin and tonic to go. Now that was a long time ago, but things have changed. Anyway, I had that Blazer.
I got to interrupt you a minute.
Okay. I'm having fun. I'm reminiscing now.
Yeah, I know. But my fear is that our friends at Clark Chevrolet Cadillac
in
Pinehurst, North Carolina, are running into their inventory lot to see whether or not you did the same things you just spoke about with your cars. with their car, which we test drove.
No, at 70, we just drove it to Harris Teeter and back
from
the grocery store.
All I can think of is these people are going to wonder what the heck. They're probably checking the body of the car right now for scuffs and dents. But no, we have to assure them. And again, this is actually to thank our friends at Clark Chevrolet Chrysler.
No, Chevrolet Cadillac.
I meant Cadillac. I'm so sorry. To thank them for
and particularly Troy Clark, who owns and runs the place, who's been just magnanimous when we called him and said, "Hey, Troy, we don't have a car. Do you have something you'd like for us to talk about and drive?" And he would say, "Sure, come over here, drive this Cadillac, or in this case, we have the new Blazer. Why don't you take it and drive it for a little bit?" And I thought,
"Now
it's just been wonderful."
If anybody within spitting distance or even across the country out of here, you can always give Clark Chevrolet Cadillac a call. But they have in stock, and I know I shouldn't be plugging, but we loved this car so much, what the heck. They have in stock a 2019 Chevrolet Blazer, the front-wheel drive Premier, at a special price. It lists for close on 49 grand. They're offering it for 46,800. This is a marvelous.
Fully loaded.
Fully loaded. This is a marvelous. They also have it in black. This one that I'm talking about is in white. But the fact is, this is such a great car, and I would never. I was going to say I would never drive that car, this car, the one that we just tested, the way that Johnny used to drive his Blazers.
Let me finish
Never let me finish my sentences. But the fact of the matter is, you could.
Welcome to my world, people.
But you could do these kind of athletic things with this new 2019 model.
No one would want to. It's too pretty a car.
But that's my point. And then I'll let you get back to your thing. So all the cars that we're seeing these days, okay, we do get the top of the line of the cars we test. But all of the cars that we're seeing now, there isn't any such thing as an ugly car. All cars are pretty. All cars have the kinds of what was a special or an extra are now standard in so many of the things that we're seeing today versus 5, 6, 7 years ago. So there's no such thing as, you know, a car that is the kind of rugged basic car that you were used to getting 20 years ago. There's no such thing anymore. And that's all part of improving, you know, manufacture. As our friend Bugsy Lawler always says, there's no such thing as a poorly manufactured, a bad car. And this is what we see with this. But you could take this Blazer that we tested, Johnny, and you could run it up and down, you know, mountains and to go off-road and some things. A front-wheel drive, not as much as a four-wheel drive, but or an all-wheel drive perhaps. But the thing is, these are made to do phenomenal things. Okay, now finish what you were going to say.
What I was going to say was, we're back to the old K5 Blazers, and Chevrolet discontinued those. They actually went to what was called a Trailblazer, which was the smaller version of a K5 and a different styling, but it was a smaller one. And eventually that went away. And they went more to the Suburbans. You know, they moved into this more of the Suburban. That was the big one that they came out with. And everybody loved those kinds of things. But we were in that gas-guzzling time when, you know, gas-guzzlers, they didn't want those kinds of cars anymore. They were looking more for the smaller, more efficient cars. Then we went back to the big ones. That was the Suburban. And finally, whoever, you know, I applaud whoever at Chevrolet decided this, but they decided to come back with a Blazer. Well, this Blazer doesn't look anything like the old K5s. And the front end of the new Blazers, if you remember, we talked about the Camaro. We had a Chevy Camaro, and how it had a monster-looking front end. I mean, it was just a beast looking at the front end of it. And this Blazer has a lot of those similarities. It's taller, of course, the front end I'm talking about. It looks taller because it's not that lower to the ground type of structure that you had in a Camaro. But it's got that same lighting across the front, of which the actual headlights are not in the top. They're actually on the sides of the grill. On each side of the grill is a light, and that actually turns out to be your headlight. But what it does is it gives a thin perspective at the top, much like something looking at you, like an animal looking at you. And it's really interesting how they've created that. So it looks good.
Are those the running lights?
Blazer.
Are those running lights?
Yeah, the running lights are up top, and your headlights are actually to each side of the grill. So,
okay.
Isn't that cool? I mean, that is cool.
Very beautiful. The look is just stupendous.
I think Chevrolet
is really doing a bang up job. They're really evolving very quickly in the last few years, I see.
One of their best commercials is where the guy talks about, you know, the different cars, and he says, and he pulls this, do you know who won this and who won that? And there's like a half a dozen of these things that are the best in their class. So I think that's good commercial, good marketing.
Now, to this point, one of our fellow, and I won't name them, of course, but one of our fellow automotive reviewers made the point that they felt that with this 2019 Chevy Blazer, that Chevy has sacrificed ruggedness for looks. And I can't agree with that. Now, granted, we didn't take it off-road. We didn't take it in any kind of place where we'd have to test it. yes, the looks are spectacular with this car. And, of course, they're trying to play into more of a metropolitan, you know, market than an off-road market, and that's true enough. But the fact of the matter is, this is a rugged car, and especially, you know, with the engine. The engine is powerful. The handling is fabulous.
Well, it's a V6. It's a 3.6-liter V6. You know, most cars anymore use four cylinders and use a turbocharger or some of those kinds of things. But that was one of the things I liked about this car. It actually has, and that's what I said, 308 horsepower V6, which is a good size engine that can carry around a lot of things or even haul some stuff. But
and to that point too, to haul some stuff, you can tow 4,500 pounds.
Right.
And if
that's
you,
a small boat though, that's not, you know, we're not talking about major stuff. It's certainly a camper.
Yes.
Certainly haul a camper.
Absolutely. But here's the thing, you know, if you get that all-wheel drive system, which is an option, you know, I do believe you can go anywhere. Now, the other comment that I want to address about that other reviewers have put out, they say that this is a very expensive car when you add in the options. Well, not the options, but when you take a look at the six different models that are offered. Okay, so L, the model Blazer L is the low end.
That starts at
30 grand.
Yeah.
Then the 25 liter in the L with cloth seats is 34 grand. A 3.6 liter engine with cloth seats is 35 grand. A 3.6 liter with leather is 38 grand. The RS is 41, and the Premier is 43, and those two are the big engine cars. But here's the thing: 43 grand for this car, fully loaded.
Well, back up, because the base model, just the base model, is 28,000.
And but that, again, that's with the 2.5 liter engine. But
yeah, the four cylinder. But my point is, it's $28,000 for a Blazer that seats five people comfortably and carries around a lot of stuff.
And people have to realize that I didn't look up when the Blazer was first produced. I should have. But the fact is, it's been around a long, long time. And it's proven.
I had one in 85, so yeah, it's been around a while.
A long time. It's a proven entity.
Hey.
Well, yeah, a long time. It's a proven entity. But here's the thing. This is an American-made car. The parts for this car are not going to be like a foreign import high-end luxury car. The labor will also not be through the roof. And the big thing is, this car is built to last you a really long time. You take care of it. You go and do all of the regular maintenances that you need to do on this car. You garage it. You take it and get it washed after it's been through salt in the wintertime, salt roads. This car should last you well. And this is off the top of my head, well into 300,000 miles or more.
Well, if you take care of it. What happens anymore is the technology is changing so fast, people don't hang on to cars more than about 100,000 miles. And for most people, that's about 5 years. Now, if you live in Pinehurst, that's about, I don't know, 10 or 15 years to get 100,000 miles because you don't drive very far. But back to some of the things you were saying, in that this new one, some of the things I love on cars, the safety features are now all standard. There was none of that when we didn't have airbags. I didn't have airbags in my old K5 Blazer. I was laughing with Hezzy before the show came on, but, you know, I used to drive that thing in the snow and you get out and get snow and gets packed snow. It gets very slick. Well, and I told Hezzy, that car would go in the snow. Of course, it didn't stop any better than any of the other ones, but a tree will oftentimes help that stopping. And I had that happen. Now, you won't believe this probably, but I hit a tree. It was, I was slow. I was trying to stop, so I had the brakes locked.
Not with the car we tested, honey.
No.
See, Clark is cringing.
No, this is the old K5 Blazer that I had, the big heavy one. And so, and it slid off the road, and I hit a tree. But you know what? It didn't even dent the bumper of the vehicle. I put it in reverse, backed out, and drove on. You know, it's like, but I told Hezzy, those are the kinds of things where you realize after you've done it that, hey, I was really lucky. I probably shouldn't be doing this anymore. So even at 25, we developed some intelligence, I suppose. Anyway,
let me just toss in before we forget, 22 miles per gallon city, 27 miles per gallon highway on this four-cylinder, and on the six-cylinder, 20 miles a gallon city and 26 miles a gallon highway, which
so
is
23 average.
Yeah, pretty good for a car like this. Go ahead, honey.
Well, this one has all of those safety features that we've come to appreciate. It has, you know, the forward collision alert. It has lane keep assist. It has airbags everywhere. It has the monitoring. It has the it has an 8-inch screen. It's the normal one is 8 inches, which is pretty good size screen. And it has I got to tell you one of the features in a second. But so when you when you're backing up, you see all of this stuff behind you. It's got a 180 degree look at what's going on behind you, which I love when I'm doing that kind of thing. The new Blazer has a really unique little thing that. When we were at Clark Chevrolet, that they were talking to me about the lady who was we were talking to. What's her name, honey? Tanya. Tanya Healy, who was there, was helping us understand some new aspects of the car.
Tanya was lovely. Thank you, Tanya.
And she said, "Do you know the rearview mirror is a camera?" And I'm like, "No." And she says, "Here, let me show you." Well, if you get in the car and you know what your rearview mirror looks like, and those of you who are have a little bit of age on you, remember that there was a switch or a lever or whatever you want to call it, a button at the bottom of the rearview mirror. If you push that lever, it basically changed the angle of it so at night the car lights didn't shine in your eyes. Remember that? I know everybody remembers that. Well, now they have something similar, but when you push that little lever, what it does is it changes your rearview mirror into the camera view. And there's a camera in the back of the car, so now in your rearview mirror, you have a 180-degree view of everything that's behind you. And it was really cool because it's a high-definition view of everything that's behind you. Here's the problem, and it'll take some getting used to for people that like it. But the problem is when you're driving down the road and you're looking ahead through the windshield, in the peripheral vision, you're seeing everything behind you. So it looks like you're driving forward and backward at the same time, which can be quite confusing. So I went back to just a regular rearview mirror. Lori tried it, and she said the same thing. You want to tell them what you thought about the rearview camera, honey?
Before you go,
I thought I was in
go,
the eye doctor.
Before you go, is that a recorded camera? Does it record everything
live?
It's live, but is it recordable or not?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay. Because, you know, they have a contraption so you can see what's going on and record what's happening behind you.
Right. It's just a live camera showing everything that's going on behind you, whether you're going down the road or not.
What was it? When the movie How the West Was Won was made, it was the first movie made in panorama vision, where you could go to
panorama.
There were special theaters.
It was called panorama.
And
in fact, in Disney World, they have that in the Hall of Presidents, where there's screens all around the circular room, and
that's what this looks like.
And this is what it looks like. It looks like a fully 180 degree vision of it. It looks like you're in the eye doctor's office trying to go for A, B. A or B?
But it's high
definition. Hard to adjust.
It's hard to adjust
your eyes, Johnny. Wrap up this because you're leaving me no time at all to talk about cars from the past.
Okay, new Blazer, remake, a total remake, not the old Blazer at all, new car, all the bells and whistles, well-priced, rides great, handles beautifully, looks super. It's a nice car to own. I'd like to have one, and that's the truth. Go.
Okay, so now, and again, thank you so much for the lone Clark Chevrolet Cadillac in Pinehurst, North
Carolina.
Okay, go. Datsun. When was Datsun first produced? What year?
I think in the 1960s.
Tell me.
1931.
Oh, wow.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yes, and it was called the Dot Motor Car Company, of course, in Japan. And the first production, the original production, was in 1931. Who knew? And originally, as I said, manufactured by the Dot Motor Car Company, their first small car production was D-A-T-S-O-N. However, they changed it in 1934, very shortly after production, to D-A-T-S-U-N, because sun, S-O-N, in Japanese means loss. So it wasn't appropriate to have a car that, you know, had that had an association with the word loss in it. But I thought Datsun no longer existed, and that's the furthest thing from the truth. Datsun was manufactured, it's owned by Nissan, but it was originally manufactured as an export car, export to the United States, and it's such a long history. You can read about it. I'll be writing this up for the Yonkers Tribune. You can read about the details there. However, the fact of the matter is, it's still manufactured. It's actually, it's being manufactured in India by Renault, Nissan, and it's the export product that is sent out to not only India, but Kazakhstan,
yeah, right.
South
yeah.
Africa, Lebanon, Belarus, Russia. So the Datsun is not... We started out thinking it was a car of the past. It is in the United States. And for a very long time before and after car production, it was a truck company. But it is still being manufactured for car manufacturing and exported, but not to the United States. And the reason is
I got to ask you the question about Datsun and Nissan. I thought that in America they sold it as a Datsun originally when it came here. But then they realized that they needed to change it to Nissan because Nissan was their international brand. And so
and they wanted
I'm surprised
to put,
that they still have Datsun in places like Kazakhstan or Lebanon or, you know, or South Africa. I thought everything was now under the label Nissan, but that's not the case? Or India?
No, not in the United States. And I believe that Datsun is still the export product for Nissan in those countries. So, but the problem in the United States was Datsun was vying against Nissan. It was vying against its own company. And so when Nissan realized they had to put, when Nissan started manufacturing and exporting Nissans to the United States as well as Datsuns, they felt it was a conflict. And so what they did was they rebranded it from Datsun to Datsun
Nissan
to just Nissan,
but
that rebranding cost the company millions and millions of dollars because they had to change all of their dealerships, all of their advertising, all of the way that they presented the Nissan brand. But Datsun, for a period of time in the United States, were only trucks. You remember the Datsun trucks, small trucks?
Yeah,
I do.
But one of the reasons...
Owned one.
Yeah, and so you would not see Datsun cars. You would see the Datsun truck. And so for a period of time, they relied on Datsun being the truck brand for Nissan. But one of the things that that made Datsun such a tremendously successful company in Japan was Japan had a law. Now, don't quote me on the numbers. I've got them, but I'm not looking at them. But by Japanese law, a car under a certain size did not require a person to have a driver's license or register the car. And so Datsun made a car, I think it was 500 something or other. So Datsun made one 450, whatever it is, cubic feet or something. And so then Japan thought this was so great because it was really bolstering up their manufacturing, you know, companies, that they increased that to 750. So then Datsun came out with a bigger car at 700. So you could drive these cars without a license, without registering them, without any of these things. You could just buy it and drive around.
Wow.
And so Japan's mindset on that, which was brilliant, was we want to and this was after World War II, we want to bolster up the industry. We want to sell. We want to, you know, encourage sales. So we're going to put as little restriction as possible on people being able to get these cars. And, of course, they were very inexpensive because they were small. Mm-hmm. So the Datsun history, which I'll write up, as I said, for the Yonkers Tribune, is fascinating, especially from the standpoint that they still are around and about, but just not with us. You know, the world actually doesn't pivot on the United States, which we're beginning to see more and more of, unfortunately. But the thing of it is that it's a very fascinating story, and unfortunately we do not have time right now, and I will also write this up for the Yonkers Tribune to talk about Triumph.
Yeah, I want to talk about that.
We can do it next week, but Triumph, you know, started out as a bicycle manufacturing company.
This is a glorious
story that we'll save for next week, but it was originally a bicycle manufacturing company back in 1885.
Really?
Then, yes, that's how it started, and then, of course, motors, and it became a motorcycle, big motorcycle, the Triumph motorcycles.
Tell me what we're going to talk about next week before you get off.
Oh, okay, next week, Johnny's going to talk about the car he spent all week driving, and I only drove twice. Go ahead, Johnny, tell everybody.
Vroom, vroom. We had the 2019 Chevy Corvette, the C7, the last ones that they're going to make before the new mid-engine one, so it was... What a beast.
God.
It was so much fun.
Johnny loved this car. Notice I said Johnny loved this car.
Yeah.
He drove it everywhere he could this week. I drove it twice so I could say that I had driven it. But I feel uncomfortable personally in a car that I have to drive totally laying down flat on my back. And having to get a winch to get me out of the car because it has 1.2 inches road clearance.
Hey, we ran over a big pine cone yesterday.
We ran over a pine cone and fell.
And we fell and then it crunched the pine cone. That's how low to the ground it was. Like, golly, dang.
What does it say? What do you say to me, Johnny, when I want to get the mail from the mailbox? You say jump or something and roll. What is?
Stop, drop, and roll.
Well, that's how you get out of this car. You have to roll out of it. You don't step out of it. Anyway, we'll talk about that next week. And in the meantime, you have a good week. We've got a little cooler weather here now, but it's going to heat up again.
Yeah.
I'll send you a write-up on the Corvette, too, Hezzy.
On
you'll,
the Corvette?
You'll appreciate
that's
it.
That's got to be fantastic. Yes. Were you driving a red one?
Oh, yeah.
Hey,
red
Corvette automatic. Oh, my gosh, it was something.
And you turn on the engine and you can hear it. You could hear it in New Jersey.
I had it in sport mode most of the time. So.
Anyway.
So it could be heard and not
good
seen.
To you, John.
So next week we'll talk about that and the Triumph. Always with you too, Hezzy.
Thank you.
All the best. And you too, John.
You
enjoy
have a good
the
week, Hezzy.
Be well.
And take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Hey, Hezzy.
Bye.
Hezzy, we didn't really let you get a word in edgewise this week, did we?
Because you were so exciting. You know, I just sat back. I listened to every word. I just love it. I know, I'm just like lapping it all up. It's fantastic.
Well, you're such a wonderful host. I think anybody else would have said, but just shut up for a minute and let me speak. Anyway, apologies for that, but we might let you in next week when we talk. Well, I doubt it because John's going to be talking about that red rocket. So anyway,
I'll
we'll try to be a little more civil.
Corvette. Absolutely. No, it's all good. It's all good. Never a problem. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care, Hezzy.
Be well. Bye. Oh, how exciting. It doesn't get better than John and Lori Wiles, Lori and John Wiles. It's just so interesting what they talk about, and there's so much depth, you know, besides the cars themselves. It's really fantastic. So there'll be a lot of interesting things to cover with the Triumph. I remember, I think that the Triumph or that division was actually sold to a Chinese company. It was part of British Leyland Motors, and I think at one time the Chinese were trying to sell the product in its revised form here in the United States, but it was quite a few years back. Don't know how long ago, maybe it's 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 or 10 years ago, and I'm wondering if ever really is still being promoted here. I just don't know. So it'll be very interesting to find that out. Well, we have things to do and things to cover. So what I want to do is then cover some international news and see where we are. Before we do that, while I prepare that aspect of it, let's just go back to the studio screen and tell you what's going on with the Cabot Creamery, and then we'll be back.
Hey, you a judge?
Sorta. I report on cheese. I don't judge.
Well, I heard on the radio Cabot Cheddar always wins awards for taste.
Well, let me see my notes. Best taste? Check. Best texture? Check. The farm families in Cabot, Vermont have won every major award in the cheese world.
Every award?
Every.
What about the U.S. Cheese Championships?
Cabot's won that many times.
How about the American Cheese Society Contest?
Cabot won it.
World Cheese Championship Award?
Best in class on cheddar.
Fiery Food Challenge?
Cabot.
International Fancy Food Show?
Cabot rules.
The Stanley Cup.
That's hockey.
Oh.
Look, Cabot's won awards for best sharp, best light, best butter, and best cheddar.
Yeah, but a certain big cheese company's TV ad show, they won an award from judges wearing bright yellow lab coats.
Oh, those are actors.
Not real judges?
Real judges wear white lab coats.
They do.
Look, Cabot is best because they own the company, ship the milk, make the cheese. They won so many times, the real judges even asked one of Cabot's cheesemakers to be a judge.
I don't believe you.
Here, taste.
Hey, I can taste why Cabot's won every award.
You be the judge.
And I get to wear a yellow lab coat.
White lab coat. Check. Check.
The best tasting cheddar on the planet is...
Time and time again.
Cabot Cheddar.
Check.
Welcome back. So, this is Westchester on the Level. Let's find out what's going on. And this is very unusual considering what we spoke to you about with regard to the Boeing. But evidently, aircraft sales soared in June, boosting U.S. durable goods, which I had not expected at all based on what we only spoke about yesterday. Seems that U.S. civilian aircraft sales raced higher in June after months of weakness from Boeing's 737 MAX crisis, a badly needed boost for the U.S. manufacturing sector, according to government data released today. But the data also showed a steep downward revision to sales in May, making the increase in June appear bigger and holding down overall sales in the second quarter. So sales of big ticket U.S. made durable goods rose by a better than expected 2% to $246 billion in June. After two straight months of declines, the Commerce Department said in its latest report. But the bounce in June came after May sales were downgraded to show a 2.3% decline, far larger than the 1.3% drop originally reported. So there was a whopping 75.5% increase in sales of civilian aircraft last month, a rebound after months in which U.S. aviation giant Boeing experienced a drought in new orders. Boeing's losses had threatened to rattle the economy, adding to a manufacturing recession and weighing on gross domestic product calculations by widening the U.S. trade deficit. Auto sales also got a nice bounce, rising 3.1% for the month. Outside the volatile transportation sector, durable goods orders rose a slower 1.2%, which was also much better than economists had forecast. So, sales of metal goods, machinery, and communications equipment all rose, but computers and military aircraft were lower. So capital goods orders for civilian use, excluding aircraft, a measure taken as a proxy for vital business investment, rose a solid 1.9% for May, the largest gain in 16 months. The clear implication is that capital spending by non-manufacturers, who account for some 80% of investment, is much stronger than the manufacturing sector, so said Ian Shepherdson of Pantheon Macroeconomics in a client note. So very, very compelling and wonderful news for the U.S. economy. So wanted to move over to some other issues. And, we'll just cover some other things. I don't know if everyone is interested in Tunisia, but its president, Beji Caid Essebsi, has died at the age of 92. So the Tunisian president, Beji Caid Essebsi, the country's first freely and democratically elected president, died today at age 92. He's a champion of equal rights for women. Essebsi sought to reconcile secularist beliefs with Sharia law. The 92-year-old Essebsi died in hospital where he had been admitted into intensive care with a severe illness. The veteran Tunisian politician was the world's oldest head of state after Queen Elizabeth and Malaysian President Mahathir Mohamad. He was elected the fourth president of Tunisia on December 31, 2014, 3 years after the Arab Spring uprising ousted the long-serving dictator Zine El Abidine Ben Ali. On April 6th of 2019, Essebsi announced he would not be seeking a second term in the forthcoming November elections, explaining that it was time to open the door to the youth. And this announcement came on the heels of protests in neighboring Algeria, which resulted in President Abdelaziz Bouteflika's April 2nd resignation and the end of his 20-year rule. Now, Essebsi showed political leanings early on. Born on November 29 of 1926 in Sidi Bou Said to a well-heeled Tunisian family, at the age of 12, he was heavily influenced by the violent riots of April 9, 1938, in which 21 Tunisians died in the name of reforms to end France's sphere of influence in Tunisia. Later, Essebsi would become active in the socialist pro-independence Neo-Destour Party. Its leader and founder, Habib Bourguiba, was a vocal advocate for the removal of French rule, who had been instrumental in the April 9 protests. And while studying law in Paris, he became a great admirer of Bourguiba's teachings, which formed Essebsi's beliefs in Tunisian independence from French rule. His first political forays could be traced back to his Parisian student years. He became vice president of the Association of North African Muslim Students, as well as an active member of the resistance against French colonial rule. Now, Essebsi returned to Tunis after completing his studies and embarked on a legal career. After Tunisia's independence in 1956, Essebsi truly came into his own politically. So when his idol, Habib Bourguiba, became president of Tunisia in 1957, Essebsi was appointed director of national security. He rose through the ranks to hold several prominent positions, including minister of the interior and minister of defense. He briefly served as ambassador to France in 1970 before returning to a law career. In 1981, he re-entered Tunisian politics with his appointment as Minister of Foreign Affairs before taking up the post of Ambassador to West Germany in 1987. A coup d'etat on November 7 of 1987 saw Bourguiba replaced by his own Prime Minister Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, and under the latter's rule, Essebsi continued to serve at high levels of government, including posts as Minister of the Interior and President of the Tunisian National Assembly. After the Arab Spring of 2011, Essebsi became interim Prime Minister on February 27 of that year, leaving the post on December 24 to be replaced by Hamadi Jebali. In 2012, he formed his own political party, Nidjaa Tunis, a diverse party made up of business leaders, intellectuals, unionists, and leftist militants, as well as members of the old regime who were allied with the Islamist and Ennahda movement. In 2014, just 2 years after the party's creation, Nidjaa Tunis swept the legislative election, which paved the way for Essebsi to run for president. Playing off his image as a wise elder, he defeated incumbent Moussef Marcouzi to become the nation's fourth president and its first democratically elected one. Essebsi led Tunisia towards numerous reforms, including gender equality and election reform. His death leaves the presidency vacant at a time of increasing tensions for Tunisia. So a very, very difficult time for Tunisia without his influence, that is for sure. Now, we've got other problems which we've already suffered here in the United States as well, but this is unbelievable. The records of heat in Paris has shown that it's at its all-time hottest day as Europe bakes in a heat wave. The record temperatures are being set in places across Europe, including Paris, as the continent swelters. Thursday in its second heat wave this summer. Climate scientists warn this could become the new normal in many parts of the world, but temperate Europe, where air conditioning is rare, isn't equipped for the temperatures frying this region this week. So tourists frolicked in fountains to seek relief, and authorities and volunteers fanned out to help the elderly, sick, and homeless hit hardest by the heat. Trains were canceled in Britain and France, and French authorities urged travelers to stay home. One by one, heat records were being broken across Europe. On Thursday afternoon, the Paris area hit 106.9 degrees Fahrenheit, beating the previous record of 104.8 degrees Fahrenheit set in 1947. Authorities said the temperature was still rising as a result of hot, dry air coming from northern Africa that's trapped between cold, stormy systems. Well, the Netherlands and Belgium also reported new record heats, and Britain is expected to do so later. The Netherlands Meteorological Institute said 104.72 degrees Fahrenheit was recorded today in the municipality of Gilze-Rijen, near the border with Belgium. That just eclipsed the 102.74 degrees Fahrenheit rate recorded a day earlier in the southern city of Eindhoven. That's in Netherlands. In Belgium, the new all-time high rose to 105 degrees Fahrenheit. This is the highest recorded temperature for Belgium in history since the beginning of the measurements in 1833, said Alex de Valke from the Royal Meteorological Institute of Belgium. Britain also expects to breach the 102 degree Fahrenheit mark for the first time after London recording its hottest day on record for July, with the mercury climbing to 98 degrees Fahrenheit at Heathrow Airport. The previous July record was 98 degrees Fahrenheit back in 2015, while the all-time record is 101 degrees Fahrenheit recorded back in August of 2003. Britain's Metropolitan Office said records go back to 1865. Unbelievable. And swaths of Germany, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, and Switzerland could face temperatures exceeding 104 degrees Fahrenheit. Germany recorded 104.9 degrees Fahrenheit yesterday, and the German Weather Service is expecting even higher temperatures today. In Austria, a two-year-old died of dehydration in the country's Styria region after he climbed into an overheated parked car without his family noticing and fell asleep in it. The Austrian news agency APA reported Thursday that the boy, who climbed into a car parked at the family's farm on Monday, died at a children's hospital on Wednesday. In the Netherlands, the Government Health Institute warned of high levels of smog due to ozone in the air in parts of the country. And the National Institute for Public Health and the Environment issued a smog alarm Thursday for regions including the densely populated cities of Amsterdam, Rotterdam, and The Hague. The Institute also said that air quality in some regions will be extremely bad because light winds mean that pollution is not being blown away and sunlight transforms it into ozone. The smog can cause irritation of the eyes, nose, and throat and leave people coughing and short of breath. Across Germany, Switzerland, and Austria, some communities painted rail tracks in white, hoping the light color would bring down the temperature by a few degrees. In Heiligendamm, on the Baltic Sea in eastern Germany, train services were canceled temporarily during last month's heat wave after the tracks were deformed by the heat. And German Railways Deutsche Bahn said that passengers who had booked tickets for Thursday or Friday and wanted to delay their trips because of the heat could do so until August 4 without extra charge. Across London and Paris, authorities and charity workers handed out water and sunscreen to homeless people and opened day centers for them to rest and shower. They are in the street all day under the sun, no air conditioning, no way to protect themselves from the heat. So for some, it's really quite complicated, said Ruggero Gatti, and an IT worker joining other Red Cross volunteers, handing out water bottles, soup, and yogurt to the homeless in the Paris suburb of Bologna. In Cologne, in West Germany, volunteers offered free water to thirsty passersby at the initiative of the city's local transportation system and an energy supplier, while others were sunbathing on the dried-up banks of the Rhine River. Tourists clustered around fountains and canals. It's too hot. In Brazil, where I live, we have the beach, but here, since there is no beach, we can enjoy this fountain, said Edison Lista Vajes, a Brazilian tourist playing with spurts of water at Trocadero Plaza across from the Eiffel Tower in Paris. France is particularly wary after a 2003 heat wave killed nearly 15,000 people, especially the elderly. Since then, the government has introduced a color-coded heat alarm system or alert system to warn people when temperatures are expected to rise to dangerous levels in their area and trigger government assistance efforts. The alert system went to its maximum level of red for the first time during last month's heat wave, when France saw its highest ever recorded temperature of 46 degrees. It's about 113 to 15 degrees Fahrenheit. On Thursday, about one-fifth of French territory was under a red alert, stretching from the English Channel through the Paris region and down to Burgundy. The National Rail Authority and Paris public transport system urged passengers to avoid travel on Thursday. Messages to hydrate yourselves came from the radio, television, and public message boards. French Health Minister Agnès Buzyn said that temperatures on Thursday are expected to be 2 degrees higher than in 2003. Some 20 million French are expected to be hit by the heat wave, she said. Summers are usually mild in much of Europe, and few homes have air conditioning. It's not that common in hospitals, stores, or restaurants either. Electric fans are selling faster on Paris, and traditional folding fans seem to be making a comeback, waved by many on the stuffy subways. So really, really unbelievable. So it's expected that 3 o'clock local time there, it'll be about 108 degrees, and same thing at about 4 in the afternoon. At 5, it'll go down to 107. At 6, about 106. And in Bavaria's prisons, inmates were getting cold cucumber soup, fruit and yogurt for lunch, and more water than normal, the German news agency DPA had reported. The heat wave is intense but expected to be short, with temperatures dropping on Friday and Saturday. As emissions continue to warm the planet, scientists say there will be more and hotter heat waves like those increasingly hitting the U.S., though it's too early to know whether this hot spell is linked to man-made climate change. There is likely the DNA of climate change in the record-breaking heat that Europe and other parts of the world are experiencing, and it is unfortunately going to continue to worsen, said Marshall Shepard, professor of meteorology at the University of Georgia. A very frightening outcome, and it's just a bit frightening, that is for sure. Well, let's see what's going on with this. With Spain. Spain's Sanchez has failed to win a parliamentary backing to form a government. Spain's parliament rejected socialist leader Pedro Sanchez's bid to be confirmed as prime minister today, putting the Eurozone's fourth largest economy on the path to what could be its fourth national election in as many years. Sanchez, in theory, has until mid-September to win parliament's backing. But the socialists said this month they would give up trying to install him if he failed to secure confirmation in July. Now, the Socialist Party won an election in April, but fell short of a majority. It needed the support of the far-left Unidas Podemos to be confirmed, but the two parties failed to reach a deal on a coalition government. A deal was impossible, Sanchez told lawmakers before adding, I want to be Spain's prime minister, but not at any price. Sanchez strongly criticized the way Podemos and its leader Pablo Iglesias had conducted the talks, but did not say what his next step would be. If he decides against a further attempt to be, or he is unsuccessful, a repeat election will be held on November 10, Spain's fourth in as many years. Spain does face several challenges for which it needs a stable government, an ongoing separatist movement in its northeastern region of Catalonia, high unemployment, low wages, and job insecurity. Since 2015, the country has shifted from a two-party system to a deeply fragmented parliament with the emergence of Podemos, Liberal Party, Ciudadanos, and more recently, far-right Vox. That has resulted in minority governments which have been unable to get any major reforms through, and Sanchez was forced to call early elections in February when his draft budget was rejected. Apart from Podemos' vote, Sanchez also needed the backing of several other lawmakers from regional parties who had conditioned their support by a vote in favor or an abstention on a deal with Podemos. The negotiations between Sanchez and Iglesias became deadlocked on the question of what role Podemos would play in a coalition government, which would be Spain's first in the modern era. 3 months of frequently acrimonious talks suggest that even if there eventually was any coalition government, it would be vulnerable to similar divisions. So, unbelievable set of circumstances, that is for sure. Now, let's look at what's happening in England. Johnson says that delivering Brexit is his mission as Prime Minister. In his first speech as Prime Minister to Parliament today, Boris Johnson described the terms of the current draft Brexit deal as, quote, unacceptable, end quote, and called on Brussels to rethink its refusal to renegotiate. Speaking to members of the House of Commons, Johnson said his government's mission was to deliver Brexit on the 31st of October for the purpose of uniting and re-energizing our great United Kingdom and making this country the greatest place on earth, end quote. Elaborating on his central theme of getting the UK out of the EU by the October 31 deadline, Johnson said he would prefer us to leave the European Union with a deal. I would much prefer it. I believe that it is possible even at this late stage, and I will work flat out to make it happen, he advised. But he added, the withdrawal agreement negotiated by my predecessor has been 3 times rejected by this House. Its terms are unacceptable to this Parliament and to this country. Britain was originally supposed to leave the European Union on March 29, but the deadline was moved to October 31 after ministers of Parliament rejected ex-Prime Minister Theresa May's withdrawal deal 3 times. Johnson was speaking to Parliament a day after taking over as Prime Minister from Theresa May following a leadership contest in the governing Conservative Party. Earlier today, Johnson held his first cabinet meeting in 10 Downing Street, where he reminded his team about the, quote, momentous task ahead of us as a pivotal moment in our country's history. We are now committed, all of us, to leaving the European Union on October 31, or indeed earlier, quote, no ifs, no buts, end quote. On Wednesday, Johnson named Brexit hardliners to top posts, including Priti Patel as Home Minister, the British equivalent of an Interior Minister. His decision to get the Vote Leave campaign team back together emphasizes how determined he is to take Britain out of the European Union on October 31, even without an agreement with Brussels. But the reshuffle caused alarm among ministers of Parliament who opposed his no-deal stance, while some new appointments sparked speculation he is gearing up for an election if Parliament tries to stop him. And Brexiteers are accused of not taking responsibility. After this shuffle, they can't be, wrote Paul Goodman, the editor of the Tory grassroots website Conservative Home. He added, these are all general election ready Vote Leave veterans. So we'll have to see where all that goes, but definitely a major concern and an issue. So we'll see what happens. Then we've got other problems. Ukraine evidently has detained a Russian tanker in the Black Sea port. Ukraine Security Service said today it had detained a Russian tanker in the Ukrainian port of Izmail for its alleged involvement in an incident in November in the Kerch Strait that led to Russia seizing three Ukrainian vessels. The Ukraine Security Service and Military Prosecutor's Office detained a Russian tanker, the Nema, which had blocked Ukrainian warships in the Kerch Straits. The Security Service said in a statement on Thursday, Russia captured the vessels and their crews in waters that separate the Crimean Peninsula, which Moscow annexed from Ukraine in 2014 to Russia. So the Ukrainian Security Service said the vessel had entered Ukraine under its new name, the Nika Spirit, to cover its involvement in the illegal action, but that it had identified the boat, or the ship rather, by its unique International Maritime Organization number, the IMO. Now, the move of the above-named vessel is considered to be a piece of material evidence, and a petition to a court for its arrest is being prepared, the Security Service said in a statement. In Moscow, senior Russian lawmaker Vladimir Jabarov described Ukraine's detention of the tanker as absolutely illegal, quote unquote, and said it was determined to relations. It was detrimental to relations between the two countries, RIA news agency reported. In Kiev, Ukraine's ombudswoman, said the negotiations on the release of the Ukrainian sailors from the three vessels seized by the Russian Navy off Crimea's coast had intensified after Russian and Ukrainian leaders spoke by phone earlier this month. So this is boiling over, that's for sure. And so we'll see where that goes. And then let's see what's going on in Afghanistan. Three blasts had rocked the Afghan capital. Government employees have been killed. Three back-to-back bomb attacks rocked the Afghan capital of Kabul on Thursday, with one hitting a bus carrying government employees, killing at least 12 people. And five employees of Afghanistan's Ministry of Mines and Petroleum were killed, 10 wounded in the bus attack, the official said, adding that seven people were killed and more than 20 wounded in the second explosion. First, a magnetic bomb pasted to a minibus exploded. Then a suicide bomber blew himself near the bus attack site. And the third blast happened when a car was blown up by unknown militants, said Nasrat Rahimi, a spokesman for the Interior Ministry in Kabul. The death toll could rise from all the three blasts, he said. Gruesome video footage posted on Twitter by the Afghan Tolo, T-O-L-O, TV station showed at least one body lying on a blood-soaked street next to the chassis of a destroyed minivan. Ambulances rushed to the scene, ferrying victims to city hospitals, and the area was closed off by security personnel. The Taliban claimed responsibility for one of the Kabul attacks. The Taliban claimed one attack targeting foreign invaders in a message posted on Twitter by its spokeswoman. Oh, no, this is a spokesman who uses the nom de guerre Mujahid Zabihullah. And the militant group denied involvement in the other two attacks in the city. Now, the Afghan government on Thursday condemned the senseless and inhumane attacks in Kabul. In a statement posted on Twitter, Sadiq Siddiqui, the spokesman for Afghan President Ashraf Ghani, said that the Taliban must be held responsible for the heinous crimes they commit against the people. The bombing comes amid an increase in violence in Kabul and around Afghanistan, where the war is taking a continued toll, even amid a U.S.-led effort to make a peace deal with the Taliban. But the U.S. is negotiating for a deal that would see foreign forces pull out of the country in return for various Taliban security guarantees, including a pledge that Afghanistan will not become a safe haven for terror groups. Some observers say the insurgents are increasing attacks to gain greater leverage in those talks. So just unbelievable what's going on. Now, let's see what's going on with Puerto Rico. Evidently, the Puerto Rico governor, Jose Yo, announced he will resign on August 2nd. It's not very far away. So Puerto Rico Governor Ricardo Rosello said late Wednesday that he will resign on August 2nd after nearly 2 weeks of furious protests and political upheaval, touched off by a leak of crude and insulting chat messages between him and his top advisors. A crowd of demonstrators outside the governor's mansion in Old San Juan erupted into cheers and singing after his announcement on Facebook just before midnight. Addressing the protests, Rosello said that the demands have been overwhelming and I've received them with the highest degree of humility. The obscenity-laced online messages involving the governor and 11 other men infuriated Puerto Ricans already frustrated with corruption, mismanagement, economic crisis, and the sluggish recovery from Hurricane Maria nearly 2 years ago. In reaction, tens of thousands took to the streets to demand Rosello's resignation in Puerto Rico's biggest demonstration since the protests that put an end to U.S. Navy training on the island of Vieques more than 15 years ago. Rosello, a Democrat elected in 2016, is the first governor to resign in the modern history of Puerto Rico, a U.S. territory of more than 3 million American citizens. Under Puerto Rico's constitution, the Secretary of State would normally assume the governorship, but since Secretary of State Luis Rivera Marin became one of more than a dozen officials to resign in the uproar over the leak, leadership of the island would fall to Justice Secretary Wanda Vasquez. She should, or rather would, become Puerto Rico's second female governor. In the 889 pages of conversation leaked on July 13, the chat participants mocked their constituents, including survivors of Maria, and made offensive remarks about women, with Rosello calling one a whore. The men also talked about politics and government contracts, and authorities this week issued search warrants for their cell phones in an investigation into whether they illegally divulged confidential government information. Lawmakers also began exploring the possibility of impeachment. Over the weekend, Rosello posted a video on Facebook in which he announced that he would not seek re-election in 2020 or continue as head of his pro-statehood political party, but his refusal to resign further angered Puerto Ricans and led to a colossal demonstration Monday on one of the capital's main highways. Pressure on Rosello to step down included calls from Puerto Rico music stars Ricky Martin, Bad Bunny, and Residente, and a string of U.S. politicians, including members of Congress from both parties and several Democratic presidential candidates. The upheaval comes as the island tries to restructure part of a $70 billion in debt and cope with a 13-year recession that has led to an exodus of nearly 500,000 people to the United States mainland in the past decade. And many Puerto Ricans are resentful over the resulting pension cuts, school closing, and other austerity measures. The economic crisis, is in part a result of previous administrations, including that of Rosello's father, Pedro, that overspent, overestimated revenue, and borrowed millions as the island sank deeper into debt. In 2017, Puerto Rico filed for the equivalent of bankruptcy. Congress approved the financial package, and a federal board is overseeing the island's finances. An MIT graduate with a doctorate in genetics, Rosello, spent much of his time as a governor fighting austerity measures and seeking federal funds after Hurricane Maria devastated the island in September of 2017, causing thousands of deaths and more than $100 billion in damage. Nearly 2 years later, some 30,000 homes still have tarp roofs. Power outages remain common, and Puerto Rico has received less than a third of the roughly $40 billion pledged by the U.S. government. And Jose Yo complained earlier this year of unfair treatment and a hostile attitude from some of the U.S. officials. The public's confidence has also been rocked by a recent string of corruption arrests involving such figures as the island's former education secretary and the one-time chief of health services. My God, trouble, 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 that is for sure. Now, let's just see what else is going on. And we were talking about Datsun and Nissan, and there's an issue that's happening as well with regard to Nissan. Evidently, they've cut 12,500 jobs as profits have plunged. So the car maker Nissan is cutting 12,500 jobs globally after its operating profits slumped by over 98% in the 3 months from April to June. And slowing car sales globally have hit Nissan hard, particularly in the United States. So that has become a major, major problem, and we'll see where that goes. Now, there is a report about this on France 24, and bear with me a moment. Bear with me a second here. Okay, let's see if we can engage this. Bear with me. This should get started in a moment. And we'll wait for it to get started. It's only about 3 minutes and a quarter long. And so just bear with me while we activate this particular video and discussion. So we're almost there. All right. Should be starting very shortly.
The carmaker Nissan is cutting 12,500 jobs around the world as its profits have plunged. That's more than double the number of job losses it announced back in May. This as the company tries to deal with the fallout from the arrest of its former chairman, Carlos Ghosn. Well, our business editor, Stephen Carroll, joins me now in the studio for more. Stephen, what exactly has gone wrong at Nissan?
Well, globally, car makers are facing a slowdown in sales in some of the biggest markets, Europe, the United States. So this is a problem facing the industry as a whole. But Nissan in particular has its own problems, partly linked to the ill effects of an aggressive expansion strategy the company had been pursuing. The job cuts, 12,500 jobs to go, more than we had expected, represents around 9% of the company's global workforce. We don't have the exact details yet of exactly where those jobs will be cut. We understand they'll be outside of Japan. This, as we've seen, some really pretty abysmal profit figures from the company. Profits, operating profits down 98% for this period from April to June. That's compared to the same period last year. Again, even worse than we had been expecting, because we had been expecting pretty poor numbers from Nissan. Now, this is not a new trend. We know that the annual results from Nissan announced back earlier in the year showed operating profits down 45% compared to the previous year. Sales were down as well by about 4%. And in that, the United States, one of the poorest performing markets.
And has this, do you think, got anything to do with Carlos Ghosn, who of course is still in custody in Japan, charged with financial misconduct?
Charges that he denies, of course, but this is nothing particularly to do with his arrest, but it is linked to the strategy that was pursued, as he was the man who created the company as it is now, really. In particular, he pushed Nissan's expansion in the United States. Nissan heavily discounted its cars there as it tried to build market share, but that led to a lower value for the brand in general, and also was seen as having hurt its image and also, of course, hurting its profits too. The head of Nissan's audit committee says that its deteriorating performance in the United States is a big issue the company is going to have to face. They're now trying to focus on growing the brand. More broadly, the company is going through a leadership change, not only because Carlos Ghosn is gone, but also because its CEO, Hirota Saikawa, the company is looking for a replacement for him as well. Other issues facing the company, of course, it's having to rebuild its relationship with Renault. Tricky as Carlos Ghosn is no longer in the picture.
And Nissan isn't the only carmaker cutting jobs right now.
No, and in the past few months, we've had announcements of huge job cuts from the likes of Ford cutting 12,000 jobs in Europe. Volkswagen announced it was cutting another 7,000 jobs earlier in this year. And last November, General Motors said that it was cutting some 14,000 jobs. And there are a couple of things going on here. One is the general slowing demand I mentioned earlier, the US-China trade war also impacting this industry. And then there's a broader change affecting the industry as a whole as people move more towards electric cars. We've got the development of autonomous driving technology as well. That's going to mean a big change for the manufacturing of cars around the world, as essentially they're going to have to upgrade or change or close down some of their plants to adapt to a changing world, and there could be many more cuts to come in the future.
Well, that's part of what's going on. So very, very interesting. Let's quickly look. Let's quickly look at what's happened in the Middle East. This is actually in Iran. Evidently, Iran announced the breakup of a CIA spy ring. I think we covered this. Some have been sentenced to death already. And Iran claims they've captured 17 spies allegedly working for the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA. And some have been sentenced to death. Iranian media reported that on Monday amid soaring tensions between Tehran and Washington. So we'll have to see where that goes and what's going to be done. And there are just so many ramifications to that particular issue. And I wanted to check just one other thing. Just make sure that we've covered all the news. Bear with me a moment. Just one more second. All right. I just want to cover just a little more. I want to go into the Asian Pacific market just to see if we're missing anything. Now, this was really quite important. Evidently, North Korea had launched two short-range missiles from its eastern shore. And so North Korea fired two short-range missiles into the sea today, South Korea's military said. The first weapon launches in more than 2 months as North Korea and U.S. officials struggle to restart nuclear negotiations. The South's Joint Chiefs of Staff said the missiles fired from the North's eastern coastal town of Wonsan flew 267 miles before landing in the waters off the country's east coast. Now, a South Korean defense official requesting anonymity, citing department rules, said that the United States analyzed one of the missiles that flew longer than the 267 miles. And some observers say that the North's intention could be to show the U.S. and others what would happen if diplomacy fails. But the relatively short flight distance by the missiles also suggests the launches were not a major provocation, such as a test of a long-range missile capable of reaching the U.S. mainland, and that North Korea doesn't appear to be pulling out of a U.S.-led diplomacy on its nuclear program. In recent days, North Korea has been ramping up the pressure on the United States and South Korea over their expected summertime military drills that it views as an invasion rehearsal. And last week, the North said it may lift its 20-month suspension of nuclear and long-range missile tests in response to the drills. President Donald Trump has considered the weapons moratorium a major achievement in his North Korea policy. Some experts say it was a negotiating tactic by North Korea to take issue with the drills in order to get an upper hand ahead of the possible resumption of talks. North Korea wants to get widespread sanctions relief to revive its dilapidated economy, but U.S. officials said the country to take significant disarmament steps before they give up the leverage provided by the sanctions. So a senior U.S. official said that the Trump administration was aware of the reports of a short-range projectile launched from North Korea. The official, who spoke on condition of anonymity to provide a response, said the administration had no further comment at this time. It was the first such launch since Seoul, and North Korea fired three short-range missiles off its east coast in early May. Many experts said at the time that those missiles bore a strong resemblance to the Russian-designed Iskander, which means Alexander, that's the way they pronounce it in Russian, a short-range nuclear-capable ballistic missile that has been in the Russian arsenal for more than a decade. South Korea's military said it and the United States military were analyzing details of Thursday's launches, and South Korea said it was monitoring possible additional launches by North Korea. During a third summit at the Korean border last month, Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un agreed to resume nuclear negotiations, which had been deadlocked since their second summit in Vietnam in February ended without an agreement because of disputes over U.S.-led sanctions. Both the launches in May and on Thursday won't end that weapons test moratorium, which applies to firing intercontinental ballistic missiles. On Tuesday, North Korea's state media said that Kim inspected a newly built submarine and ordered officials to further bolster the country's military capabilities. Korean Central News Agency said that the submarine's operational deployment is near at hand, quote unquote. After analyzing North Korea dispatched photos of the submarine, experts said the submarine likely has three launch tubes for missiles. South Korea government documents say North Korea has about 70 submarines, but analysts say they mostly have a single tube launch or launch tube. So the construction of such a new submarine suggests North Korea has been increasing its military capability despite nuclear diplomacy that it began with the United States early last year. The latest launches came amid a recent flare-up of tensions on the Korean Peninsula after South Korean fighter jets on Tuesday fired hundreds of warning shots to repel a Russian reconnaissance plane that Seoul says violated its territorial airspace. Before that alleged intrusion, Seoul said Russian and Chinese airplanes, including the reconnaissance aircraft, made an extremely unusual joint entrance into South Korea's air defense identification zone, prompting South Korea's military jets to scramble. Now, Russia and China have said they carried out their first joint patrol in the waters between the Korean Peninsula and Japan, but said none of their planes violated South Korea's airspace. Experts say the joint patrol may have been aimed at testing readiness of trilateral security cooperation among the United States, South Korea, and Japan. So, boy, there's a lot of stuff going all over the world, isn't it? So, just amazing. Okay, let me just look one last time to see if anything else has been happening here in the Americas. Bear with me a moment. This is interesting because I didn't expect this. Former U.S. Special Counsel Robert Mueller testified to Congress on Wednesday at a pair of televised hearings to carry high stakes for President Donald Trump, and Democrats are split between impeaching him or moving on to the 2020 election. So we'll have to see what the fallout from that particular, just a revelation of what's going on. Oh, I forgot to look up this thing for you. Bear with me a moment because I only saw it in the New York Post. Bear with me a moment. And let's just see if we can get this for you. Yep. Jeffrey Epstein is on a suicide watch after he's found with neck injuries in jail. So the New York Post reports that Jeffrey Epstein was on suicide watch after he's found with neck injuries in jail. Convicted pedophile Jeffrey Epstein, been placed on a suicide watch after being found sprawled out and injured in his federal jail cell. Law enforcement sources said on Thursday, that's today, and Epstein was nearly unconscious in his cell on Tuesday at Manhattan's Metropolitan Correctional Center with injuries to his neck. That's what sources advised. The multimillionaire financier, who's being held at the jail without bail pending trial on child sex trafficking charges, was rushed to a nearby hospital. On Thursday, the 66-year-old was back at the jail and on suicide watch, sources said. Investigators believe he may have injured himself on purpose, perhaps as a ploy to get transferred out of the jail. Now, Epstein was busted on July 6th over the alleged sexual abuse of dozens of young girls in his Upper East Side townhouse and his waterfront mansion in Palm Beach, Florida, between 2002 and 2005. He's pleaded not guilty and faces up to 45 years in prison if convicted. So we'll just have to see what happens there. But it's a frightening situation. And I hope they can keep him alive. And I just hope that they can keep him alive, because this way he can go through the embarrassment of being outed for what he's done, which is very, very important that people know. Now, this is very interesting. Faye Dunaway has been fired from a Broadway-bound Tea at Five for slapping a crew member. Oscar-winning actress Faye Dunaway has been fired from the Broadway-bound play Tea at Five for creating a hostile and dangerous quote-unquote environment backstage that left production members fearing for their safety, several sources told the New York Post. On stage at the Huntington Theater in Boston, where Tea at Five was trying out, Dunaway was playing Katherine Hepburn. Backstage, she was channeling Joan Crawford, the deranged, abusive film star Dunaway played in the 1981 movie Mommy Dearest. The July 10 performance was canceled moments before curtain because Dunaway slapped and threw things at crew members who were trying to put on her wig, sources say. And enraged at the cancellation, Dunaway began verbally abusing the crew. They were fearful for their safety, one source had said. So Dunaway was traveling in Europe and could not be reached for comment. Her lawyer did not respond to an email seeking comment. The producers of Tea at Five said in a statement they had terminated their relationship with the actress. They said the play, which was well received in Boston, would go to London in the spring and be recast with another actress. Tea at Five is a one-woman play by Matthew Lombardo about Hepburn's recovery from a car accident in 1983. It was meant to be a triumphant return to the stage for Dunaway, who famously was fired by Andrew Lloyd Webber before she opened in the Los Angeles production of Sunset Boulevard. Dunaway, who won her Oscar as the ambitious television producer in Network, was excited to return to Broadway for the first time in 37 years. Her last appearance was in the 1982 play, The Curse of the Aching Heart. She seemed committed to the role and fun to be around, said a source, but her behavior was unsettling at an early photo shoot. Someone gave her a salad for lunch and she threw it on the floor. She was watching her weight and said that the salad would be better on the floor than in her hand. She was frequently late for rehearsals, sometimes up to 2 hours, sources say. She refused to allow anyone to look at her during rehearsals, including the director and the playwright, although she had the script for 6 months. Sources claim she was never able to learn her lines. During the run of the play at Huntington, she was fed lines and blocking through an earpiece. And one source said 98% of the play came through the earpiece. While in rehearsal, she left what one production source called troubling, rambling, angry voicemails to the creative team during the middle of the night. She also insisted that no one wear white to rehearsals because it distracts me, she said. When she was rehearsing on stage at the Huntington, no one was allowed to move in the theater because that also distracted her. As she was rehearsing, she began to lose weight. She looked so emaciated that a production member called Dunaway's former assistant for advice. The assistant said it sounds like she's not complying with her medication. And the producers were so concerned about her condition, they called Actors Equity Association to see if it was ethical to put someone in her state in front of an audience, sources said. And over the last weekend in June, she had a full-on mommy dearest break meltdown and demanded that staffers at the Huntington Theater get down on their hands and knees and scrub the floor of her dressing room, sources claim. She allegedly threw mirrors, combs, and boxes of hairpins at the staff of the theater. She also pulled gray hairs out of her wig because she wanted to play a younger version of Hepburn than the playwright had written. The producer knew they had to fire her when they had to cancel the July 10 performance because she physically and verbally abused several production members. This is not the first time Dunaway has displayed erratic behavior in a show. In the early 1990s, she toured the country as Maria Callas in Terrence McNally's Masterclass. She showed up an hour late for many performances. She had bellhops rearrange her furniture in a hotel suite in the middle of the night because she didn't like the flow of the room. And my God, and once a theater in St. Louis sent her a white limousine, and she reportedly had a fit because she hates white. She demanded a rental car from the hotel to get to the theater. The limo company sent a black car instead, but it was too late. And Dunaway was racing to the theater, trailed by both the white limo and the black one. I managed to track her down back then, and she was charming on the phone. Your story sounds like a Fellini movie, she told me. I haven't been able to reach her in Europe for this story, but I hope wherever she is, there are no wire hangers. Interesting. And this was reported by Michael Riedel, an exclusive in the entertainment section of the New York Post. Absolutely just insanity. She's evidently unhinged, or so it seems, based on the report. So that's really a problem. I don't know what happened. Sometimes things like that happen, or maybe she's always been that way. Who knows? But great actress, for sure. She was brilliant in Network, but you know, people don't want to tolerate all these sorts of abusive language and throwing things. Oh my God, you know, and I can't imagine that Michael Riedel, of all people, would write something that he hasn't been able to get validated because he is such a brilliant writer. So there, that is the story. That's how it looks. Well, we have nothing more to discuss with you today. Oh, you know what? Actually, I do have one more thing I wanted to mention to you, and that is what I wrote about an editorial yesterday. This has to do with Mount Vernon, and I hope you find it interesting. So the title is Mount Vernon City Court Must Validate the Present Caretaker Government in Anticipation of Final Results Voted Upon in the November 5, 2019 General Election. So the editorial is called The Chain of Command, and the first line to remember is, a functioning demeanor will be in place for a mayor to assume office on January 1, 2020, likely to cheers and amen. A sense of dread, ambivalence, and foreboding is smothering Mount Vernon's collective capacity to strategically plan to extricate itself from many years of past dysfunction, including the self-admitted guilt exacerbating a sense of foreboding, uncertainty, and angst over the prospect of losing one's livelihood. It was on July 10 of 2019 that the Mount Vernon City Council determined that Mayor Richard Thomas, upon admitting to and pleading guilty to Mr. Beaner's and misuse of campaign funds on July 8th. It was all due to his noncompliance to Article 25 of the Mount Vernon City Charter, which required him to relinquish his capacity and station as mayor. Instead of adhering to the guidance set by the Mount Vernon City Charter, Thomas chose to be dismissive of Article 25 and did not submit to the statute as it was defined. While Thomas was contemplating his next move, Mount Vernonites were suffering an overabundance of anxiety because their fear was exacerbated to a greater extent by media more concerned about viewers, listeners, readers, and click-throughs than the hoped-for transition from dysfunction to function envisaged by most Mount Vernonites. Thomas's arrogant and dismissive submission to the city charter was an error that diminished what loyalty and or capacity he held as mayor. He too ratcheted the anxiety level in the city by creating a sense of being mayor when he knew he no longer was mayor. Andre Wallace was voted the new mayor. Janice Duarte was voted the new city council president. The government of and with Wallace, Duarte et al. Were in charge. The hierarchy was in place, but there were forces clinging to days that had long expired. And Andre Wallace must beseech the Mount Vernon City Court to rule over the ouster of Richard Thomas from office based on the guidance described by the city charter, the elevation of Andre Wallace to mayor, Janice Duarte to city council president, Sean Harris to Mount Vernon police commissioner, among others, so as to delete any ambiguity of city employees and residents of the chain of command until a new mayor is voted for in November 5, 2019, and thereafter sworn to office by January 1, 2020. Mount Vernon Comptroller Deborah Reynolds is being recognized to have stood her ground for reasons that she recognized were compliant with her responsibilities, and thereby she did not make payment to entities to which she did not obtain corroborating evidence rationale from Mayor Thomas to corroborate appropriate disbursements of funds to authorized business entities. The admonition and ridicule she endured were suffered by her not fully explaining her conduct publicly. Then again, she was demonized by Mayor Thomas's assault on her integrity. She will have the last laugh because she continues to stand for the principles to which she has conformed. And interestingly, rumblings whispered by Thomas to a chosen few informed that he is contemplating a run for the office of Mount Vernon Comptroller. Bear with me a moment as I attempt not to hurl a revulsion to the prospect I may not have hurled, but I did sense an acrid taste in my throat. Comptroller Reynolds last week paid Thomas a few days' salary rather than a full week's salary. Yonkers Tribune, Mount Vernon Tribune, has learned that Mount Vernon Police Chief Rickton Ziotti has been informed by newly reinstalled Mount Vernon Police Commissioner Sean Harris to strip Richard Thomas of his mayoral security detail and remove the two officers posted outside the mayor's office. Should Mount Vernon Police Commissioner Harris's orders not be carried out, Yonkers Tribune, Mount Vernon Tribune contemplates Comptroller Reynolds will likely exact a financial penalty from Police Chief Rickton Ziotti. Those that have the foresight vision for Mount Vernon must serve the public interest by serving them and none other by every measure that is best for the majority of its residents. So that's the story. Well, so we're at the end of the line here, and we'll speak to you tomorrow, and be well. Thank you very much for being with us today. Okay, here we are. So have a great day. Goodbye.